This is the Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Pat Crawley. He is the founder and CEO of Shapul, a company that makes protein-rich energy bars made, believe it or not, from crickets. That's right, crickets. Before you get too queasy, think about this. Humans have been eating insects for protein since the beginning of time. And if you care about your food's impact on the environment, Pat's energy bars may start to make a lot more sense. First, and importantly, you cannot tell that these energy bars have cricket flour in them. Second, it turns out that raising livestock for protein consumption is terrible for the environment. It takes a lot of land, and more importantly, it takes a lot of water to raise livestock. Plus, these animals produce a lot of pollution. Some pundits claim that nearly 20% of all greenhouse gases come from livestock. Apparently, crickets are much less flatulent than cows, and they are more efficient at converting feedstock into protein. Join us this morning to hear how one young man went from being a surf and whitewater raft guide to an entrepreneur who is creating an entirely new food category in his desire to ensure future generations have access to sustainable water sources. Along the way, Pat pitched the investors of ABC's hit show, Shark Tank, and much to my surprise, Pat landed Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, as an investor in Shapul. Pat Crawley of Shapul Energy Bars, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Yeah, absolutely. We're excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start at the beginning. How did the idea for using cricket protein in energy bars start?
Yeah, it always takes quite a bit of explaining. Way back, I did a fair amount of international travel, and through those travels and through academic research, decided that I wanted to pour myself into what I thought was one of the biggest issues the globe faces, which is access to fresh water and our overconsumption of our freshwater resources. So, you know, I had hitchhiked down through Mexico and Central America, so I saw firsthand, you know, the issues of access to fresh and healthy water, and then decided to come back to the United States, get an education in water resources, and through that education, realized just how unsustainable our water usage is here in the United States. Essentially, we're draining these vast resources and literally consuming the water of our children and grandchildren.
So, I mean, are we at risk of running out of water?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to put a finite date on that, but absolutely, we have pools of fresh water that are available to us in the form of groundwater, surface water, and then in clouds in the form of precipitation. And we're overdrafting our groundwater resources in this country at an alarming rate. You know, some of the largest aquifers in the world are here in the United States, and you know, the Ogallala Aquifer, and we're rapidly diminishing that resource. Same with California. It's a pool, it's a bank, if you want to think about it, that we're overdrafting, that our children won't have access to in the future. So absolutely we are, but it's not on the forefront of everyone's mind, unfortunately.
No, it's more so than most of our natural resources. It seems like something that's always going to be there. I mean, as we speak, Salt Lake City just has experienced 2 weeks of pretty major storms. We're at record snowfalls. I just heard this morning California's had the most precipitation year to date ever recorded. So it does seem like it's an unlimited resource. You went back to school. You're a hydrologist. You got your degree in hydrology. So you know better than most that it's not limited. How does this tie into crickets, though?
Yeah. So essentially, that's the lens that I was looking through. And the majority of our water consumption in the western half of the United States and globally, it's about the same figure. It's 80 to 90% of our water usage goes to agriculture, our food.
Say that again.
80 to 90% of our water usage in the western United States and globally, it's up to 92% of all water use is for agriculture.
That's shocking.
Yeah.
So, you know, if somebody had asked me what the biggest water use is, I would have guessed, you know, agriculture would be one of the tops. But I think, unfortunately, all of our lawns are a huge user of water as well. Where does us sprinkling our lawns fall on that?
Yeah, that was one point of frustration for me as a water planner, is that's what we talk about with empowering the everyday person of where you can have your conservation efforts have an impact in watering your lawn, turning the tap off when you brush your teeth, installing a low-flow toilet. But that's about 15%. All domestic water use is about 15% of our water consumption here in Utah specifically. So it's a small sliver of the pie that we're telling you you have the ability to impact, when in reality, the true impact of our water consumption lays in your dinner plate and what you decide to eat on a daily basis.
And so your thought is crickets are much more efficient in the use of water, or is it more have to do with the grains that they live off of and eat?
Yeah, so that's primarily what we're growing in agriculture in the U.S. is feed for livestock. So when you look at converting that feed, instead of feeding it to cows and pigs and chickens, which are fairly inefficient, especially cows, feed that to crickets instead. And you have a tenfold increase in the amount of available protein that we have as a country. And that's really just the beginning point. That was really what got me excited about it. But then looking at even further long term, as far as increasing the food security in our country, you know, we're facing a changing climate. And the best strategy for having an unknown future is to have a diversity in our food supply. And we've been trending in the opposite direction. We've been trending towards more monoculture, and you know, through the industrialization of our food supply, we're having fewer and fewer species, which is not a very good risk management strategy for food supply, for financial portfolio, for really anything. And truly, diversity equals health.
That's a good point. And how did crickets end up on your radar screen? Was it something you were looking for a solution, or did somebody start telling you about crickets and insects and it go from there?
Yeah, the real trigger point was a TED Talk that I listened to. I was on my way to work riding the bus downtown here in Salt Lake City, and I listened to a TED Talk from a Dutch professor that just outlined all the benefits of eating insects, how they're eaten all over the world. Most cultures used to eat them, and it was really just Western Europe that didn't. And then when Western Europeans expanded to the U.S., kind of wiped out the practice here amongst most Native American groups. And so that was really the catalyst for a deeper dive and investigation into edible insects. And so after I learned about that, I plugged myself into the basement of the library here. Every day on the way to work, I come in a little early and just read all about, you know, historical insect consumption amongst, you know, Native Americans and worldwide. And I started crunching those numbers from a water resource perspective. And that's really where I got excited about just insects in general. And so I decided that I wanted to introduce it to our food supply, and thought that the most effective way to do that would be at the consumer level, rather than start farming crickets when there wasn't a consumer demand for them. I'd start at the consumer.
That's a good way to go out of business very quickly. Start in the supply side rather than the demand side. So that was actually really smart. Did you have somebody advising you on that, or was it just common sense to you?
No, I asked advice from anyone that was willing to give it to me. So I went to the SLIC Small Business Development Center. I went to SCORE International. Any sort of free, you know, business entrepreneur advisement I would seek, and then anyone that had a personal connection, had a food company or worked in the food industry, I would pick their brains, because I didn't have any background in food, in business. So I was under advisement throughout the entire process.
Well, you had some good advice. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Pat Crowley. He is the founder and CEO of Chapul. So how did the cricket end up being the insect of choice?
Yeah, so knowing that I wanted to start at that demand side rather than the supply, you have to have some sort of supply chain in place. And so it turns out we've been raising crickets in the United States for close to a century. It started out for fish bait industry, and then in the late 60s, early 70s, we started raising reptiles as pets. And so the cricket farming industry grew around that. And so there's about a dozen large-scale farms. And so there was some infrastructure in place for a supply chain. So I started with crickets for that, just as much as everything we're doing is a psychology, cultural introduction, and cricket has a fairly benign kind of image in our country, and we have cartoon crickets, and you know, compare that to a cockroach. Or,
yeah, well, you had your mentors, and Pinocchio had his mentor,
yeah,
which,
exactly,
if I'm not mistaken,
exactly,
was a cricket named Jimmy.
Jiminy.
I've got two teenage daughters, and so I've had frogs as pets, and I have gone to the pet stores to purchase crickets. And if I'm not mistaken, they're like they're not cheap. They're like 25 cents each.
Oh, that's
which doesn't take a lot of crickets to add up to a very expensive energy bar very quickly.
Yeah, we have about 30 crickets per bar, and so you're absolutely right, and that's kind of the bane of our cost of goods right now, is because there is that high margin market available.
You know, how much do you have to? I mean, what is 30 crickets cost you?
Yeah, significantly less than what you would buy them at a pet store for. And so we've kind of walked hand in hand through the supply chain with these farmers to raise them for human consumption. So it's significantly less than what you would buy at retail, but it's still over half the cost of our bar, even though it's you know, 10 to 20% of the ingredients.
Yeah, and the good news for the consumer, the cost of your energy bar, and we'll talk more about the bar in a little bit, is about the same price as of what another high quality energy bar would cost. So it's in line from the consumer standpoint.
Yeah, we knew that we had to have all things be equal or better. We knew that we had to compete, take crickets out, we had to compete at taste, at price, at texture, at the nutrition values.
Let's talk about taste and texture.
Yeah.
I think, you know, people are thinking, you know, crickets, they're, I believe the term is a crustacean, they have an exoskeleton, so they're thinking crunchy, they're not too sure what the taste of a cricket would be. I should share ahead of time, you were kind enough to bring some sample bars. Myself and our show's producer, Ross Chambliss, did some taste testing. They're delicious, so let's just put that out there.
Thank you.
On it. But you actually start with cricket flour,
right,
as opposed to the cricket itself. Do you make the flour? What is cricket flour, and do you make it?
Yeah, we started making it. The name Chapul, that's the name of our company, is an Aztec word for cricket, and we basically mimic their process. What they would do is they would dry them out in the sun and then would mill them with stone tools. And so we dehydrate them, we slow roast them in convection ovens, and then we put them through a stone mill and mill them down to a fine powder, essentially. And so we started calling it cricket flour, because that's a more recognizable term in the food industry. So everything we're doing is all about the psyche of introducing insects to a culture that isn't familiar with eating it. And so by making the flour, we eliminate this foreign visual component. We eliminate, like you were saying, this foreign crunchy aspect of it that may be a potential source of unknown fear.
What does the flour itself taste like? Does it have a bitter taste? Is it sweet?
It's pretty mild. Earthy is a good term. Sort of like sunflower or amaranth flour, if you've ever had that. Quinoa, fairly similar to grains. They're so efficient at converting their feed into biomass. They mimic, the taste mimics kind of what they're eating.
Interesting. And, you know, in some of the research I did, you allude to other food categories that had to kind of climb up the, hey, U.S. citizens aren't used to eating this product. And there's two examples that you use. One is sushi and one is lobster. Tell us, you know, I think of both of those, sushi and lobster, as a delicacy that's expensive.
Yeah, right.
And when I feel like celebrating, you know, I splurge a little bit more when I'm at a restaurant and get something like that. But that wasn't always the case. How did sushi and how did lobster end up on the American plate?
Yes, sushi. So one of the advisors I had early on said, don't, you know, you're launching something totally new, so don't reinvent the wheel. Look at other industries that had a similar hurdle that you have, being a cultural introduction of a new ingredient. And so they said, like, look at the history of sushi. And I knew nothing about it, and it was really fascinating when I dove into it. But it flopped early on in the mid-60s until somebody very strategically crafted the California roll as a cultural introduction. So they took the raw fish out, put avocado in, and has the same texture as raw fish. And then they put the rice on the outside of the nori so that we didn't have to see this foreign-looking seaweed. So those were the real cues that we picked up on, is, you know, eliminate as much foreign elements as possible, visual, textural, And so we knew we had to create kind of the California role of insects. And so that was the design. That was the concept around the energy bar. And then the lobster has a really fascinating history as well. Like you said, it was considered a junk food. They were called sea bugs, actually. And there was actually New York State Penitentiary had a mandate that it was considered cruel and unusual punishment to feed their inmates lobster more than 3 days a week. And so they had to limit lobster on the menu.
May I be treated so poorly?
Right. And then it was a very concerted marketing effort by, New England lobster industry, fishing industry, to turn it into this high end. And now it's, one of the highest priced proteins on the market. And so it was very deliberate.
So you've been in the market for a couple of years now, I believe 2012.
Correct.
When you started. So this is 5 years.
Yeah, we're going on 5 years.
How's that journey of changing consumer minds towards the idea of insects? How's that journey going?
It's from our perspective, it's mind blowing how far it's come. The very first introduction of eating insects was at the downtown farmers market here in Salt Lake City and Park City Market. And we were blowing people's minds. People had never heard of the concept, or very few people anyway. And as we've gained momentum, nationally and internationally, there's several other companies now doing this. There's companies that make cricket flour. There's farms that are now entirely dedicated to raising insects for human consumption here in the U.S. that didn't exist before we kind of put it on the map. And now when we go to an event, specifically in natural food category for people that are, into health food and, healthy for you, healthy for the environment market, it's very rare that somebody has not heard of the concept. There's a couple pivotal events. One, we won this really big national award as the most innovative food product in the U.S. in 2014. And so that really put it on the map from an industry perspective. And then
that's a big deal. I wasn't expecting you to say it was a food category that you won. I thought it was going to be a sustainable food or an insect trade group.
Right. No, this was presented to us at the Natural Products Expo, and 70,000 attendees. And we were nominated. There was 100 nominees, and it was, General Mills product was nominated, and Kellogg's had a nomination, and Clif Bar had a nomination. And then this tiny little company from Salt Lake City with two employees got nominated. And lo and behold, we won this award. And so then there was just a lot of press in the industry about it. And it was actually, that event was in March of 2014. And so was our Shark Tank appearance. So it was kind of this 1-2. We got this huge press at the industry level and then also at the consumer level with the Shark Tank appearing to over 6 million Americans.
That was a good year for you guys. Let's take a short break. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Pat Crowley, the founder and CEO of Chipul. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Pat Crowley, founder and CEO of Chipul. So I want to get to Shark Tank. I want to get to some of these other pivotal places in your business. But before we leave the subject of crickets itself, it has some pretty impressive nutritional characteristics. Share with our audience some of that, like the percent protein, percent fat versus maybe a cow.
Yeah. So it was kind of this gift that I didn't realize. I came at it purely from that sustainability element. And then, the more I researched, the more I realized just how incredibly nutritious they were and how that alone is the marketing platform now. It stands alone just from the nutritional benefit. So it's a complete protein. So it has all the essential amino acids, which a lot of plant proteins are missing. People that are looking to eat more ethically or environmentally conscious, trend towards more of a plant-based diet, but a lot of them are missing those essential amino acids. So it's a really strong position there. And then it's also really high in micronutrients. So it's high in B12 and iron, which is also something very deficient that most, vegetarian trending or flexitarians are deficient in. So it gets this very strong nutritional component to it.
I'm going to share a couple things that I picked up in some of your previous talks. both a cow and a cricket is about 60% protein, at least the processed parts of them. But a cow is 40% fat versus a cricket is 20% fat, and probably more important to the main mission and cause that you care about. If you take 10 pounds of feedstock, it produces 1 pound of a cow.
Of cow, yeah.
Versus 8 pounds. It produces 8 pounds of crickets, and that's a huge difference.
It is, and it gets even more efficient when you look at, so 1 pound of cow, only about 50% of that is actually edible to us, where a cricket, it's about 80 to 90% is digestible. It's all edible, but it's the other 10 to 20% is just fiber. So yeah, it's staggering how much more efficient they are at converting what we're already growing in this country into a very healthy protein, more healthy, more sustainable. So it just wins in all categories.
How does that compare? I've heard that chickens are much more efficient than cows at converting feedstock into protein.
Yeah, you get about 5 pounds of chicken. So they're about a 2-to-1 ratio. But okay. But that ratio has, we've tweaked that model over the past, you know, 80 or so years. And so it's a very hyper-focused diet that goes in that addresses a very specific chicken metabolism. And so this is the starting point for crickets. And so as we continue to tweak that process, the efficiency is only going to increase from here.
That's a good point. And you know you're making an impact on the consumer's psyche when you have some PhDs doing studies. And I know there was a study out of UC Davis that said, well, actually crickets and chickens are about the same. And you were quoted in a response to that saying exactly what you just shared, which is we haven't optimized it yet.
Exactly. And so when the starting point is equal, that's huge for the potential. And there's so much room for efficiency. There has been very little innovation in the insect growing space because of exactly what you were alluding to earlier of how expensive they are at the retail level.
You have fools like me paying 25
exactly.
cents a cricket.
Why would you optimize that when you have a 500% margin?
It's crazy, too, when you go to the store and you see the bags of cricket. I mean, there's just hundreds, if not thousands of them. In these bags, and people like me go and buy 10 of them at a time or something small like that.
You know, that's actually been one of the most rewarding things about starting this project is, you know, we started at that consumer level with sort of an element of faith that the supply chain would backfill and that brilliant minds would start diving into the problem and see the value in it. And so there's dozens of very innovative projects at the university level to raise insects on vegetable bioproduct and in these incubators that just increase the efficiency, decrease the manual labor that goes into it. And so just seeing everything that's happening and all the inspiration, innovation at that level, at the supply chain level is really rewarding because it's exactly why we started this.
You know, that brings up a really good point. Utah has a very strong foundation, its universities do, in agricultural studies. Have there been some local universities that have helped in some of these challenges you guys have been facing from the agricultural and the raising and producing that supply chain?
Not yet here. We've definitely had interest. Initially, I had just about every farmer that came up to me at one of our booths said, well, you can come and have all the crickets you want from my field. So it was a very informal invitation. But you know, I'd be extremely excited to work with more Utah-based agricultural extension agencies to increase the optimization. But mostly what we've had help with here in Utah is at that consumer-facing product. There's a tremendous food science department down in BYU. Utah State University has an excellent food science department up there, and both of those were just extremely useful in the development of the company as well as kind of the ongoing development of the psyche and the marketing campaign around what consumers' feedback is being.
I'm glad to hear that, you know, because I think that's one of Utah's secret components is just how well the universities and the private sector and just as importantly, the political leaders work together. We still have a lot of differences, but I think when it comes to creating healthy businesses and an environment to help entrepreneurs like yourself. I think Utah score is really, really high. I moved here from California, and it seems like that combination of academia, entrepreneurs, and legislative leaders, Utah's doing that better than probably most states.
I agree with that 100%. Yeah, we actually had additional support from the state of Utah. And we received a grant from the state to develop this finer powder specifically for, you know, continuing our mission of increasing the food security of our country. So it's been great to have that support at the state level.
Was that one of the TCIP grants?
Exactly, yeah. Technology Commercialization Innovation Program from Department of Economic Commerce.
Yeah, those things have really helped a lot of companies in its early days. So I'm glad to hear you were a recipient of that as well.
Yeah, and it was great. This year they did, or it was last year, and they did a kind of a startup accelerator program in association with it. Boom Startup did it, and so just as much as kind of the financial backing, being around all these other innovative companies here in the state of Utah that are really progressing technology in the state was just as much of a benefit in increasing the collaboration in an already collaborative atmosphere of here in Utah.
Yeah, we've had Rob Coons on, who's one of the founders of Boom Startup here. So yeah, it's great to have them here in the state as well. So you talked about 2014 being a pivotal year.
Yeah,
I have down that 2012 is when you did your Kickstarter campaign, which gave you your initial funding. Before I went to your Kickstarter page, and one of the things I like about Kickstarter is they keep up the old campaigns, so you can still go see them. But as I was clicking through trying to find it, I was thinking to myself, if I was Pat, how much would I make my Kickstarter campaign?
Yeah, right.
Because if you don't reach your goal, you get nothing.
Yeah, all or nothing.
So you've got to set. And I'm like, you know, maybe 10,000, because crickets would be pretty tough.
Yeah.
Which was exactly what your goal was. You ended up raising a little over 15,000, I think just a tad over 16,000 through that. How did you come up with the idea of Kickstarter and decide that maybe that would be the seed money that you needed to get started?
Yeah, it was kind of a multifaceted decision, but it's a tremendous asset, and it really has changed the landscape, not just Kickstarter, but just the crowdfunding model in general of, you know, I didn't have a lot of savings to pour into this. So we started to pool kind of pre-Kickstarter with just a few thousand dollars. And especially in the food space where you have to spend money on inventory, and then the traditional models, you have these net 30 invoices where you deliver, you pay for all the ingredients, you package it, you deliver it to a store, and then you get paid 30 days later. So from day one, you're behind the cash flow game. So crowdfunding basically flips that model around, and you get ahead of the cash flow game from day one. So essentially, you get money up front from your consumers saying, we'll give you money, then you go buy the ingredients and then deliver on it. And then, you know, we took that profit that we took from Kickstarter and bought the next batch, brought it to the farmer's market. And so we were bootstrapped
it's
from day one,
idea,
didn't have to take out any loans, pay interest.
If you don't have the money, and a bank's not going to loan you money
for
a startup. If you don't have the money yourself, and even if you do, you probably shouldn't put 100% not just your time and effort into the company. That's expected from an entrepreneur. But when you start putting your entire bank account into the company, now you've really ratcheted up the risk. And Kickstarter is great because everybody pays a little bit of money, or I should say most people pay a little bit of money. I did notice one of your pledges was for $1,500. Whoever pledged that got to spend time with you and your co-founder. You offered a whitewater rafting trip, which is what one of your professional passions was.
That's
before
right.
Shapul. Yep. I'm curious. Tell us the story about the person that pledged $1,500 to go whitewater rafting with
Yeah. You. So you have the option on Kickstarter, each incentive level. And that was our highest incentive level.
There were some for like $5, get a sticker, and support the team. Right?
Yep. I mean, that's majority of what we had was just a sampler pack. There's four bars of our flavors and get to try the product at a discount. You have the option on Kickstarter to remove an incentive if nobody's bought into it yet. And it was the day before the campaign was closing. And it only made financial sense for us if two people bought into the whitewater rafting trip to cover the costs. And the we were like in the hours of deciding whether we were going to take it, and somebody bid on it. And so
that was actually a good deal, $1,500 for a guided two-day
guided
whitewater.
We picked them at the airport, all expenses included. And so it was this couple from Tucson, Arizona. None of us knew them. And so it wasn't, you know, a family member. A lot of times you have these family members kind of
altruistic. I was hoping it wasn't, or it would have been an awkward story for you. So it's even better.
Yeah, right.
So were they passionate about your mission as well, or do they just really like whitewater rafting?
No, yeah, exactly. They really liked the story. They liked the motivation of what we were doing. You know, from Tucson, they're familiar with water stress issues. And he was, the husband was former military and really liked the, you know, the food security component of it. And so, and he also was really excited to take his wife camping. And he said, your mission is to get my wife to like camping. We said, oh, great.
That's a tall mission. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So we kind of wrote it off. We said, okay, we're not making any money on this incentive. Let's just bring everyone along that donated their time in Chipotle, because this was very much a volunteer-based startup. We had just a bunch of friends coming in helping make all the bars to send out the incentives. We had about 12 people in the kitchen working. None of us were getting paid. And so all of us went on this whitewater rafting trip, and they fit right in, and they had a great time, and we're pretty good friends with them. There's a little video clip on our Facebook page you can see from that trip. But it was it really meant a lot. We did it in Westwater Canyon on the Colorado River, and that's really a big source of inspiration of this project. I've worked in the Colorado River Basin, and you know that's a river that doesn't flow to the ocean anymore because of agricultural pull from it. And so, you know, that being on that water body funded by a passion project to do something about it and have a tangible solution-based, you know, project was pretty incredible.
Well, you've said a lot of interesting things there. One, you know, a mighty river that no longer flows to the ocean. And the other thing is just your team of volunteers that helped in the early days. Let's start with your team of volunteers. So you had this idea, you had this passion, really the Kickstarter campaign was the launch of it as a business.
Right.
How did you get other like-minded people to help out?
Yeah, I think it was just the passion. And more, that's a really, it's a value that people, especially the you know millennial generation, it buys into is a mission-based project or company that has such higher ranking in priority of, you know, their day-to-day job that you want to take on. If you can believe in what you're doing, it resonates a lot more now. And so we just had a lot of friends that were really excited about kind of the passion that had gone into this and really understood the concept of doing something better to better our future. And so to spend, you know, a weekend in the kitchen to be a part of something bigger than any of us as individuals was really rewarding for all of us. And we tried to make it as fun as possible, of course.
You seem like you'd be fun to work with. So I'm sure that's a big factor of it. But, you know, entrepreneurs often struggle with their business idea because some of the ideas that people are most passionate about may not be the most lucrative or maybe a much harder path than some others. And it's easy to identify the challenges, right? You're going to start making energy bars using crickets. I mean, that's just filled with all kinds of challenges you can see from day one. But what's harder to see from day one is the things that are going to go in your favor, particularly in your case, because of the importance of that mission.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think knowing all of those hurdles that we had to go over was also a motivating factor for Kickstarter, in that you don't have to invest early on to creating this product. It's a product validation in and of itself. And so you kind of throw the idea out there to the crowd saying, does this resonate with you? Does this make sense? Do you buy into this value proposition? And you get immediate feedback, and the feedback was yes. You know, our project was only online for about 2 weeks. It was about just over 2 weeks. And so real short project. And in that time, we had almost 400 people, you know, purchase our product. So,
well, and you know this, 80% of the Kickstarter campaigns do not get to their minimum required to actually get it funded.
Right.
So that's not only does it help from a source of capital, but it also says, you know, there is consumer interest here. People are willing to support a cause like this. So let's switch gears now. We talked about the Kickstarter campaign. it must have been around 2014, actually, my sister, who lives in Cleveland, Ohio, called me up and said, hey, do you ever watch this show called Shark Tank? And I'm like, what is Shark Tank? You know, I'm thinking it's a show about fish, or it's an the Baltimore Aquarium reality show or something like that. And she's like, no, I think it's, I do a little bit, not much, but a little bit of angel investing. And she's like, I think it's kind of what you do. And I'm like, really? So I turned it on, and if I'm not mistaken, your episode was the first one I ever saw.
Oh, no kidding.
And you were like second or third in the queue.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking, wow, that's a tough business. And as I said in the open, much to my surprise, Mark Cuban decided to be an investor. And most people know Mark Cuban, but if you don't, he is a billionaire, and he's probably best known for being the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. He's also one of the thought leaders in this show called Shark Tank, which is like a group of venture capitalists trying to decide if they're going to invest or not. So tell us about the Shark Tank experience. How did you get on their radar screen, and what was that like filming that show?
Oh, yeah, that was a wild experience. I just submitted an email. That was, you go to the website, and they said inquiries. You can submit this email, or you can do a live audition. But we just submitted this inquiry, and they said, you know what, we're really late in the application process, so just like if you can get us a video in the next couple of days, we'll submit it. And so we actually told our video intern that had done our Kickstarter video, we said, hey, we don't have any money to pay you, but if we get on Shark Tank, we'll give you $1,000. And so he shot this video for us, and he was rewarded for it, you know, 6 months later. But anyway, they really liked the concept. It seemed like it was going to make good television. You know, they wanted live crickets on the set.
I was wondering if somebody asked you to do live crickets, because
we don't normally do that.
Yeah, I was going to say that works against your goal of trying to get people to.
Absolutely, but it makes good television, I guess. And they wanted us. The producers wanted me to have the sharks eat the bar and then tell them what it was. And I was like, absolutely not. That is so contrary to what we believe in. You know, we're promoting this as a healthy option. We're not surprising people. And, but the live crickets actually worked to my advantage, and because they bring in, once they accept you as a company, they bring in about twice as many companies as they have room to film. And so they have like a roll call. They bring you in, you stay in a hotel, and they have you come down the lobby, and they say, okay, you 10 companies come with us, and you're going to film today. And they usually get to about 7 or 8, and then the numbers 9 and 10 go home. They fly back, and they never even get to tape. And so they had me scheduled for later in the day. I think it was like 8 or 9 in the lineup. I said, hey, listen, I don't think these crickets are going to survive all day long. I think I need to be earlier on for this. And they said, oh, that's a great idea. We're going to put you number 3 in the lineup.
Right. That was smart.
But I actually wasn't – I was thinking about not doing it, because I had – it was the same date as a Grand Canyon rafting trip that I was working. It's a 14-day trip. And it was the first trip I was going to be working with my wife, who's also a whitewater rafting guide. And so I said, you know, this is a really high priority in my life. I'm not going to do Shark Tank. And they were like, I don't think you understand what you're passing up. I was like, no, I don't think you understand. This is the Grand Canyon. but it worked out. I was able to do it right after. And so it's probably the largest kind of 180-degree world universe transition I've ever done, from going the Grand Canyon, no money, no, you know, vehicles, no television, no computers, no cell phones, to, you know, Culver City, bright lights, cameras everywhere. And but anyway, I filmed, and it was probably about an hour conversation I had with the sharks, just about the company and the
merits.
It
gets filtered down to maybe 10 minutes at most. Yeah.
So, and you don't know what's going to make the episode or not. And so I filmed in September, and then they don't actually tell you if you're going to make an episode or not. So they don't film all the companies they bring in, and then all the companies they film don't make it to airing, because they need a lot more content so they can kind of weed through what makes good TV and whatnot. And so the advice they gave was, to make good television, you have to have high energy and make the sharks laugh. So I was like, okay, so that's going through my head just as much as I need to secure an investment. So I'm like, I have to be entertaining, make good television, but also secure an investment in a serious way.
Well, it worked. And as I recall, Mark was the only one that decided to come in. Right?
Actually, Robert, that's what tipped Mark over the edge, is Robert came back in. He said he was out. And then representative of when we go to an event and any people come up to our booth and, you know, there's inevitably people are immediately like, I'm not into it. But then the more they hear about it, the more the emotion kind of subsides and the logic kicks in. They say, actually, this is a good concept.
And I think I might booth, be. I'm guessing you're at these food shows where people like Whole Foods and Sprouts and these major retailers are there. Is this the type of thing that you're at?
Yeah, but then also we go in when we're in a store. We sell here in Natural Grocers, Liberty Heights Fresh, Dave's Health and Nutrition. And in March, we're launching in all 17 Harmon's locations. So we go in to the store, cut up the bars, and sample them to the customers that are coming into the stores. I've interacted with thousands and thousands and thousands of people, their first time ever hearing about eating insects. Some of them are, you know, have heard about it, but they've never tried it. Some of them are like, I grew up eating insects in Cambodia or Japan or, you know, South America. And you just hear these really fascinating
stories.
There's
a really funny YouTube video of a young lady that does a taste test with her family. If you do taste test, Chapul, which is spelled C-H-A-P-U-L.
Correct.
C-H-A-P-U-L. You'll find this really funny taste test where she's an immigrant family and her parents have eaten bugs. And it's just funny listening to them talk because they're like, oh, we've roasted different, and they mentioned the different bugs, and it's like, it's just too much work, you know. Yeah, they're tasty, but it's just too much work.
Yo, I agree with that 100%.
I do too. It's like, you know, I've had lobster, and I've had friends say, hey, crawdads, you should try crawdads, and it is a lot like lobster, but it's a lot of work, and there's not that much meat in a crawdad.
That's actually one of my favorite things, is hearing all these stories, and they're constantly, I'm constantly hearing new ones. One of my favorites was, it was at a green drinks event here in Salt Lake City, and this gentleman was from Japan originally. He said when they were kids, they would catch wasps, and then they would throw them in the freezer, and their metabolism drops, and essentially they kind of fall asleep, and then they tie a piece of silk onto their leg, and they thaw them out, and when they thaw out, they kind of wake up, and they fly back to their nest, and they have them on a leash, and they follow them back to their hive.
Don't try this at home, people. I'm sure this wasp was pretty ticked off, too.
But then they scoop out all the wasp larvae, and that's a delicacy in Japan, is fried wasp larvae.
Well, it's funny you say that, because in this video, the way I said that the parents had eaten bugs before, and the mom was saying her favorite was the eggs of ants.
Yeah, exactly.
Same thing, a delicacy there.
Yeah, there's some 1,900 varieties of insects known to be eaten around the world.
And it's, I believe I read somewhere like 80% of the world's population does eat insects on a somewhat regular basis.
Exactly, yep.
Just not us and not Europe.
And that you have to preface that of like consciously. We eat insects all the time. You can't get them out of your food supply. So if you eat any packaged product or any can of soup or any tomato sauce, peanut butter, chocolate, it's loaded with insects. You can't get them out of our fields. And so,
in fact, when I was in high school, my teacher that was teaching us about regulations and business rules, brought in some from the food safety group, probably, I don't know, the USDA or whoever regulates that. But it shows, like, for a chocolate bar, you know, you're allowed to have so many insect parts in a bar before they say, you know what, actually, you can't sell that.
Yeah, and it's purely an aesthetic rationale. It just like we have water quality parameters around color. You can't have blue water, but, you know, it's perfectly safe to drink if you put a little food coloring in. But it's not an actual safety issue. It's just an aesthetic issue.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Pat Crawley. He is the founder and CEO of Chapul. So earlier you were talking about other suppliers of cricket flour and some competition. Was there cricket flour available in the supply chain prior to you guys?
Nope, there was. Yep, no real such thing. We were the first ones to call something cricket flour, So we brought the crickets in direct from the farm, and we had to tweak their process of how they actually sent them to us. So their normal business model was to send live crickets. And once we started having a regular order, then we got them to invest in a freezer. They would freeze them and send us frozen crickets. And so we kind of developed the process. And now there's farms that do the processing and make the flour on site. But we've maintained that process as well. So you can purchase them from the farms now directly, but you can also purchase them from us that we, you know, tweak it a little bit. And
how do you feel about the competition? I mean, you may have been able to get a patent on this. I know that you're borrowing from a process that the Aztec Indians used. Apparently the Utes here, you have an interesting story about some caves where crickets were grown and likely harvested and eaten by the Utes. Did you think about trying to protect the idea of cricket flour?
I did. But what it really comes down to is that looking at it from a long-term perspective of increasing the health and sustainability of our food supply, I was entirely motivated by spreading an idea as opposed to owning one. And I haven't really been financially motivated necessarily. And so this was very much a passion project of spreading this idea. And the more players involved, the more companies helping to spread this, the more effective our mission is of increasing our sustainability of our food supply. So that's really the kind of the philosophy behind it. But also from a business perspective, business strategy, we were viewed as this lone crazy company and now we're viewed as a company in an innovative industry. And so you have to have multiple companies to create an industry. And, everything we're doing requires just multiple touches of marketing this idea. And so we're all contributing to the same end goal of increasing the awareness around insect consumption. And so financially, it's been rewarding as well to have multiple players in the game. So, from this environmental perspective, but also from a business strategy, it's made sense to really foster a collaborative environment within the insect protein category.
Yeah, I suspected that's how you would feel about protecting the idea of cricket flour. That would be something that you'd say, well, actually, what I want to do is create this sustainable water source, and I want to minimize our reliance on cattle and other inefficient use of animals for protein. So I thought, given your values and your mission statement, that's how you'd feel. How about your investors? I know Cuban's an investor. Do you have other investors in your company as well?
Yeah, so it was myself and a co-founder were the initial investors, like I said, just a couple $1,000s. And then we did Kickstarter and bootstrapped it from there. And then we had Mark Cuban with a relatively small investment.
$50,000.
In the food world, that's not much. It's pretty expensive to have a food company and to have the marketing around a pretty low margin industry. And so it was fairly abnormal to grow to the size we did without taking more investment. But just recently we took on some more angel investment money that was pretty strategic. So angels in the food space or in conscious capitalism that are adding to the team as well as just our financial security.
Right. So let's talk about the team. As you look at the things that your company's good at and has done really well, and also look at some of the things that you want to get better at in the next couple of years, what are those areas that you'd like to kind of get additional strengths that maybe you don't have on your team today?
Yeah, we're focusing a lot more on online sales. And so the reason we're doing that is because we have the feedback that we get, the positive feedback that we get is we have this really authentic story. And that is so hard to tell in a compelling way in the retail storefront. And so online, you just have a much greater storytelling capacity. And so we're focusing more on telling the story, developing content online, and then marketing that to be really the thought leaders in a space that we created, essentially, as opposed to kind of being drowned out by all these newcomers to this new market.
And so what I'm hearing from that is you feel that consumers make the decision that they want to try, they want to be regular eaters of Chipotle energy bars before they get to the store. And while they're grocery shopping, they're like, I want to pick up these Chipotle energy bars, as opposed to seeing them on the shelf and saying, oh, what's this? Maybe I should try that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a couple of second sound bites that you have on the packaging to tell the story of why crickets. And, you know, when you asked me that, it took me 5 minutes to tell you the true story of it to, you know, what is in a compelling way. There's so many elements of it, you have to really understand the problem that we're addressing before you understand mm-hmm. us as a solution to that problem. And it's just you have a lot more opportunity to tell that more in-depth story online.
So you brought us in some samples, and I mentioned I like the packaging of it. And on the outside, you've got a slogan, Dare to be Different. And then on the inside, it says Dare to be Your... Actually, I can't find it now, but I thought it said Dare to be Yourself. It's here somewhere. Oh, there it is. Yeah. Dare to be Different and Dare to be You. Where did that come from, and why are those taglines important?
Yeah, that's a pretty in-depth understanding of who our early adopter market is. You know, now over 4 years into this industry, we have an understanding of who those early adopters are, where they didn't exist when we started in day one. And what we've realized and what we've come to learn is that a lot of people are doing this or trying it for the first time for that sense of adventure. Or that was the compelling reason to try it that first time of, wow, this is kind of scary, but I'm going to get over that and try it. And it's exciting to do. And when you do that, you're bucking kind of cultural norms, and you're going to have people around you that kind of turn their nose at you or say, ew, gross. And that's going to be directed at you. And so it takes an element of courage to leave that behind and break free of kind of mainstream cultural norms that, you know, aren't that well thought out now, or potentially putting our culture in an unsustainable trajectory. And so it takes that element of courage to leave that behind. And we want to be that outlet for that courage and that sense of daring to be different and to be who you are in, you know, whatever motivates you to, whether it's a more sustainable environment, whether it's adopting a healthier diet and not really care what other people around you think.
Yeah. And I think people lose sight of the science that goes into consumer packaged goods.
Man. Yeah.
So let's talk about that. Like, how did you, so the story you just told on those two taglines were very compelling.
Yeah.
But there were many different taglines you could have chose.
Right.
Talk to us about the science behind how did you decide those were the right ones?
Actually, we had a lot of help from a student group down in BYU in the MBA program. And so they used us as a project, and they interviewed a lot of our early adopters, people that had repeat buys, and they did an analysis using the ZMET marketing methodology. And so it's basically taking the consumer on this journey from your product attributes, turn them into product benefits, then what are the personal benefits, and then the final kind of pie in the sky, where you want to get the consumer, is this emotional level and having an emotional connection with your brand that's aligned with their personal ethic and vision of who they are. And so I realized it was this epiphanal moment. I was at this food marketing conference that I was speaking at, but there was all these brilliant people, and they were all trying to map out how the money that they spend to try and get that consumer up to that emotional level. And here we are, people come to our product and they have an immediate emotional response. It's just one of fear. And my strategy was to present logic and take them down to the kind of personal benefits or the product benefits. And I'm going the opposite direction of all these other conventional marketing strategies. And so we decided, let's just keep that consumer at that emotional level. You know, they come in, they're potentially afraid of something new, and let's just celebrate getting over that fear and stay on the emotional level and just turn fear into courage. And we're coining the term emotional jujitsu. So just a slight shift of momentum, turn that fear into courage.
A slight shift of momentum, but where you're starting is a really challenging place for a product, right? Because you use the word fear.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably fair. You know, the thought of eating crickets, or as you said on Shark Tank, they wanted you to bring in live crickets, and they showed a close-up of that and the shark's reaction, and there was some cringing going on.
Yeah. Well, that's the really interesting element of this, is there's a lot of science coming out from some psychology departments that have adopted analyzing this disgust factor, yuck factor, in particular with insects. And there was one that came out that dissected it all the way down to, it's just neophobia. It's fear of the unknown. And so we're programmed to eat what our parents fed us. And anything that looks different is a little bit scary. And if it's really different, it's a lot of bit scary. And it kind of turns into this like, ew, gross. Like,
but you're right. I think there is a jujitsu move there where you can take, you're out on the spectrum of emotion. And I think something that elicits that type of emotional response, you can use to your advantage as well. It's not easy. It takes creativity. It takes passion that you obviously have a lot of for this. But you can take it to, it's something that people are passionate about in a positive way as well.
Yeah, and I think we have a very solid theory. And so it's just the putting that into practice is the most challenging element.
You've convinced me. But as you said, it's a story, and you need time, and it's not something that lends itself to 2 seconds on a grocery shelf. So how did you get your venture investors? You mentioned after Cuban came in just recently, you've brought in, it sounds like, 2 venture capitalists, one that has a food background, and another one that is more into conscientious investing. How did you get them over that curve?
It just purely numbers. We've been growing at a pretty good rate and at a really impressive lack of investment money. It's just been bootstrapping, which is, we have a very healthy company, financially
healthy
company.
Are those Utah venture capitalists or are they out of state?
No, we presented to a few Utah companies, but there's not a lot of food investment here in Utah. So we were
Food is hard. You need somebody that knows food.
Exactly, yeah. So we presented at several pitch competitions in Boulder, Colorado, and San Francisco, and a lot of these big events in California.
And share with our audience like the Clif Bar story. Different, but a lot of similarities between what you're doing. That was a huge success. Do you know any of the...
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the numbers?
Yeah, that's actually a great book by Gary Erickson. It's called Raising the Bar.
And Gary's dad is named Clif.
Correct.
And is why Clif Bar is called Clif.
Yeah. Yeah, very similar beginnings of just bootstrap, a little local kitchen bakery. I think he had a lot more industry experience. He had worked in a bakery, so he understood the elements of it a lot more than we did as hydrologists and rafting and surfing guys jumping into it. But so they started very, very kind of passionately about good food and healthy food. And, you know, what was on the market at the time was pretty did not resemble food. And so they had this tremendous growth. And the story of Raising the Bar is all around this kind of pivotal moment. I think it was Quaker offered to buy Clif Bar first.
And they agreed to initially.
He agreed to, that's right, for hundreds of millions. I think it might have been $200 million or something like that. And he claims that he had $15,000 in a savings account. And they were going through with it. And then kind of 24 hours before signing, he had this pivotal moment of, you know what, I'm not doing this.
It gets worse because he had a partner.
That's right.
His partner wanted to sell.
Yes, that's
so
right.
So he
that's
had right. to buy out his partner at that price. Not only did he just have $15,000 in the
that's
bank,
right.
but he had to mortgage his house and everything else he owned to pay off his partner.
Yep, that's right. Yep. And it's paid off.
It worked out extremely well for him.
Yeah. Yeah, they're the number 2 energy bar company. And
so it can be a big space, which I'm sure helped a lot with convincing the venture capitalist to come on board, as does being able to do the impossible with very few resources. And I think Utah scores very high on that. We have scrappy entrepreneurs that get a lot done with very little money. And it's
actually, that was one of the biggest appeals to Mark Cuban. There's one element that he's definitely a visionary. He wants to see the industries that are coming next, not that are here today. And so he saw that element of our food system, and this makes sense in the future. And so that, I think that resonated. But then also, we were at a product launch in a chain of grocery stores in Texas, and he came out for it and rolled up his sleeves and was cutting up our bars and handing them out and talking about them. And somebody asked him, why did you invest in this? And he just said, this guy right here, and it was, he invests in actually a lot of Utah companies. They're
Shark Tank loves Utah, and there's an episode there somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. But it was precisely that kind of roll up your sleeves, just get it done kind of business ethic and history that we had. I think that was compelling.
Awesome. So we've just got a few minutes left, and I want to wrap up with kind of your journey. And I want to preface this, you've taken a non-traditional path to where you are. You mentioned a surfing guide, a whitewater rafting guide, decided to become a hydrologist, and now you're an entrepreneur making energy bars out of cricket flour. And there's a really rich story there. We don't have time for a lot of it, but the angle I'd like you to look at is, I think kids today are under a lot of pressure. I'm the father of two teenage daughters, and they very much feel like they need to make every decision right, or the dots aren't going to line up and they're not going to get into the college of their choice. There's just so much pressure on our youth today.
Yeah.
In hindsight, your dots line up and you can tell an arc of a story that is compelling and makes sense. But at the time, going forward, it's hard to see how that's all going to connect. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Actually, I remember graduating college and not having a clear direction. I graduated a degree in psychology, a bachelor's degree in psychology, and what sort of career opportunities are there are fairly limited. And I remember my grandfather kind of talked to me. He understood I was having this kind of directionless moment, and he said, don't get too worked up about mapping out your path. And he kind of traced the story of his path, and very happy man, and great family life, and you could have never planned out his route. And he said, that's going to happen. And so just one step at a time, and opportunities are just going to constantly present themselves, and you just go in that direction and as they come up, but you won't be able to map it out. So don't get worked up about trying to do that. And although I've had a very kind of laser focus on, increasing the sustainability of our water resources over the past 10 years, that's what I've been focused and working on. The path to do that has been so radically different from day to day that I never would have been able to plan that out. I think the most challenging part for me is the focus on this long-term vision of a better future and really working towards that, but not sacrificing kind of the day-to-day happiness that I need as an individual. And, especially as an entrepreneur, it's just all too easy to work, 18-hour days and then sacrifice your personal health and, take time away from your family. But that's really what generates the source of happiness kind of at an individual level and fuels that passion and is so important to maintain just as much as, passionately working towards, a better future for my son and his children. So
It's a great note for us to end on. You mentioned sacrifice. I'll share with the audience my closing comment here. In the green room, before we started this interview, Pat was mentioning that he went to bed at 5 a.m. this morning, not because he was having fun out in the town, but because he was working hard. And that's the life of an entrepreneur. So, Pat, thank you very much for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Our guest this morning has been Pat Crawley. He is the founder and CEO of Chapul. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. You can hear our entire interview with Pat on our website, kcpw.org, or The Bottom Line Podcast. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.